Engaging conversation on the most urgent problem of our day and what you can do about it.
Now, the End Abortion Podcast by Priests for Life.
Well, hello, I'm Janet Morena, the Executive Director of Priests for Life. Welcome to Just Ask Janet. Well, today's topic you might find a little shocking. You know, a woman schedules an abortion and she does so many for very conflicted reasons, feeling she's not ready to be a mom and a lot of different reasons. Sometimes she's being forced into the abortion and she thinks, you know, okay, that's it, problem solved. But do you realize that sometimes the abortion fails? It fails, and then a baby is born alive? Uh-oh, and then what? Well, joining me today is a woman that happened to her. She was that baby that survived the abortion, and we're going to hear right now about her compelling testimony, but not just her story, but what she has done with her story to bring others to healing and to really wake people up of what happens to babies born alive from an abortion. So welcome to the program, Melissa Oden. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Janet. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it was my pleasure. And of course, we've known each other for quite a long time. I'll never forget the first time I heard your story when you gave your testimony was, I believe, at a National Right to Life convention. That was a ways back when all these things surfaced about the born alive bills and different things were happening and your story came out. But take our listeners back to that story of how you found out that you survived an abortion as a baby.
Yeah, this happens, and you wouldn't know it by anything you hear in our world today. I grew up knowing I was adopted, that I had been born prematurely, that I had some health issues. And honestly, Janet, never once could my mind have fathomed that all of those things were related to surviving a failed saline infusion abortion. When I was 14 years old, my family experienced an unplanned pregnancy themselves. My older sister, as a high school student, was facing an unplanned pregnancy. And like so many women in that position, was fearful, didn't know what quote unquote choice she was going to make. And so when our parents found out that she was considering an abortion, they decided to tell her my story. My mom and dad had been told about my survival when they adopted me. I was special needs because the doctors weren't sure what my life was going to look like or what disabilities I might face. And so, like so many parents in that position, my mom and dad had carried that story throughout their lives. And, you know, honestly, I don't think they planned on ever telling me or anyone outside of the adults in our family. And then lo and behold, this, you know, unplanned pregnancy happens and our parents decide they need to do something to hopefully save the life of their grandchild and save the life of their own daughter who was considering an abortion. So they told her my survival story, and it was in the middle of an argument one night that she let it slip to me that there was more to the story of my survival. And, you know, it was not pretty. It was a couple of teenage girls fighting. And that was the night, a cold October night at the age of 14, that I ultimately had to sit my mother down and ask her to explain to me why my sister felt like she was more wanted by her biological parents than I was by mine. We're both adoptees. I just couldn't even fathom why she would think she was more wanted than I was. And that night, my mom had to tell me something that no parent should ever have to. That is the night that she shared with me that I had survived that failed saline infusion abortion back in 1977. And it was absolutely devastating.
You know, I mean, I can just imagine, first of all, your mom, like, finally having to tell you. I mean, that must have been, you know, painful for her, because I think for parents, we always wonder, should we or shouldn't we tell kids certain things and when? You know, the whole question of just being adopted, I know, is always, when do we tell them and how do we tell them and all that. But then in your case, it was almost like someone tried to kill you. You know, you were meant to be dead, and here you survived. And then your parents really stepped into faith, your adoptive parents, mm-hmm. because they, like you said, they didn't know if you were going to be disabled or what would happen. Tell us a little bit about, now you survived the abortion. Who got you out of the abortion clinic? I mean, how much of this story do you know? Because we hear, as you know, with the Kermit Gosnells and these horror stories, that a lot of these babies are born alive. These abortions kill them. They kill mm-hmm. them. So who rescued you from the hands of the abortionists, and how did you end up with your adoptive family?
Yeah, it's really taken me most of my life to learn as much of the story as what I know now. You know, when I was told at the age of 14, my adoptive parents were told that it was my birth mother Ruth's choice to have the abortion. And they had been told that the abortionist laid me aside at the hospital and demanded that I be left to die. And that's horrible enough on the face of it all. And really, at the age of 14, those were some of the most devastating parts of it. Of not only, you know, did someone try to take my life, but they also didn't want to save my life after I first survived. And so that was really, really difficult for many years. And even after, you know, 2019, when we saw this coming out of Virginia and Ralph Northam, Governor Ralph Northam, talking about laying them aside, having a conversation, it brings back all of that trauma that I've had to go through and process and heal from. But in my case, we now know that it wasn't the abortionist who demanded that I be left to die. So here I soak in this toxic salt solution of the saline infusion abortion for 5 days. And then when I'm accidentally delivered alive in the final step of the abortion procedure, I am laid aside. My medical records show it was probably about 5 minutes that I was laid aside, just because you can tell by my Apgar scores that I had went from being, you know, in not good shape to nearly dead. And, you know, we now know that in those 5 minutes, the person who was demanding that I be left to die was my own grandmother. And I know that my story is dramatic, but I can tell you that I am not the only person that these circumstances happen to. I think what makes my story, you know, dramatic is, A, I know as much as I do, and I have documents that spell so much of it out. And B, yes, it was my grandmother who forced the abortion upon Ruth when Ruth was 19 years old. But she could do it because she was an OBGYN nurse, oversaw many nursing students. She ended up being the associate dean of a nursing college that I later was attending college at. That's a whole other story. But she had the means and the knowledge to force that abortion, monitor it at the hospital as it was happening, and then come face to face with me that day when the abortion failed and I was delivered, and then demand that I be left to die. Now, gratefully for me, there were nurses on staff who, even though they knew they should not defy her, they knew her well enough to know that they shouldn't do that, they did defy her orders. And I now know that at least one nurse rushed me off to the NICU that day and believed that if they found out, that maybe the medical care could be started that would sustain my life. But no child should have to have their life depend on who is working that day.
Right. Yeah. I mean, thank God for that nurse. Now, did you ever get to meet that nurse?
Not that one nurse in particular. I have been blessed, though, to meet a couple of nurses who played a big part in my survival and my healing. So the first person who had approached me years ago was a nurse volunteer who held me and rocked me at a second hospital that I was transferred to. And she knew my story just because I was still nameless a couple of months later. And the nurse was saying, why is this baby almost, you know, 2-3 months old and this baby doesn't have a name? And so that's how she found out my story. So she first found me all those years later, and she's a good friend of mine now. And then when my book, You Carried Me, which I do have here, my book, You Carried Me, came out a number of years ago, a nurse reached out to me by email and had said, you know, I've seen you on TV. I've been following you for years. And I always wondered if you were the baby that I knew from St. Luke's Hospital in Sioux City, Iowa. And she said, after reading your book, I know that it's you.
Oh, wow.
So, isn't that amazing?
That's incredible. So now you got transferred to another hospital. How did your adoptive parents then find, you know, come to get the opportunity to adopt you? And when did you get your name, Melissa? How long did that take?
My first name was Katie Rose. I know that. So the nurses in the NICU named me Katie Rose and, you know, knitted me clothing and booties that I still have today. My kids have played with that with their dolls over the years, which, you know, isn't that just such a beautiful, you know, testament to impacting somebody's life. But I was ultimately named Melissa by my adoptive parents after a friend of the family who had overcome a really significant car accident that left her disabled. They just really admired her. And so that's how I got my name. And I'm grateful for that because I think I have that spirit. But my mom and dad had adopted my older sister. So my sister's 4 years older than I am. They had fostered children before that, but then they adopted my sister. And, you know, I think what's so fascinating about my parents adopting me is they were told at the beginning of August of 1977, when their home study had been updated, you know, it said, listen, we don't know when you're ever going to be able to have another child placed in your home because there's just so many people above you on the list waiting for a child. And then the end of August of 1977, somehow my parents are the ones who got that phone call. And I don't know how many people said no to me before that. I'm totally okay with that at this point because my parents were the people who were supposed to say yes. And so, you know, my parents traveled a distance to meet me for the first time. And, you know, those are some of my favorite stories. My mom will tell you the moment that they laid eyes on me, I was full of tubes and wires still. My head was shaved. You know, I always joke and say I wasn't the prettiest baby at the time, but I was to them. And my mom always says, you know, the minute they laid eyes on me, they fell radically in love with me.
So now, were you ever able to make contact with your birth mother and your grandmother who wanted you dead? I mean, has any of that happened or no?
Yeah, it's a long and winding road, I think, in many people's lives to find bits and pieces of story. So, you know, I found out my story at 14, started looking for answers and people when I was 19. Didn't find them for over 10 years. So when I was about 30, which is about the same time I came forward in the pro-life movement, God's timing is always perfect. But I found my biological parents through my medical records in 2007 and did reach out to my birth father and unfortunately never heard back from him. He did end up passing away before we ever could communicate. And at that time, I couldn't find Ruth through my searching. She had married someone else after the abortion had occurred. And so I knew her maiden name and not her married name. But I found her parents back in 2007. You know, I didn't know back then that my grandmother played that huge role in the abortion taking place. And I sent them a letter asking for them to just pass along my messages to Ruth. And looking back on it now, sometimes I can't believe I did that. But I'm grateful that I did because I hope that it brought them some peace to know that I'm healthy, I'm alive, I'm well, I'm not bitter, I'm not angry. They did correspond with me just a little bit, but it was really just kind of opening the door a crack to say, you know, we received your letter. Obviously, you know, your live birth was not the intention. And they shared a couple things about Ruth that I think are so common in people who are affected by abortion. You know this, Janet. You know, right. They shared that she had never told anybody about her abortion, right, and that they no longer communicated. Abortion impacts people's relationships.
Right. Yeah, it really does. You know, and sometimes I think what happens is they have that abortion, they're traumatized by it, and then they just stuff it way down. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you by the testimonies of women from Silent No More, so many of them said, when I walked out of the clinic that day, I knew I'll never talk about this ever again. And it gnaws at them and gnaws at them. And eventually they seek healing. But now you're married, you have children. How did they come about? Like, did you tell them your whole story? I mean, because you're so public now and you have a book written, which we'll get to in a minute. But how old are your children and have you shared with them?
Yeah, my oldest is now 13. My youngest is seven. I know, 13. She was.
I remember when she was a wee little one.
Yeah, she used to fall asleep at my feet at podiums. You know, she was the kid. She would hate that I say this, but she had these beautiful chubby cheeks. Oh,
I remember them.
Yes, she had these beautiful cheeks, and she would be the child at all the pro-life events grabbing all the fetal models, you know? She would take her fetal models to the pregnancy center locally and give them powder baths together. You know, that's what it's like to grow up in the pro-life movement. And I love that because that's so important to me, that we raise our children with firm beliefs about life and allow them opportunities to put it into action. Because now I have this 13-year-old who plans on running for Congress someday, and I think she's going to do it. And that's legacy. That's so powerful to me. But my kids know my story. So my 13-year-old in particular, this was so much how she was raised. And she's an old soul. She was born very wise. And so she knew things. I can remember, Janet, one of the first times I took her to a March for Life, and she saw an image on a van of an aborted baby. And she was little. I mean, I would say she was probably 3 years old at best. And she said, "Mommy, who broke that baby?"
Wow.
And that still today resonates with me. Sure. And it's hard to have those conversations with our kids. But, you know, I always tell parents, we give them as much as they need to know at that point in their development.
You know, Melissa, that was so important what you just said, because little kids get it. Mm-hmm. Like you just said, your daughter said, "Who broke the baby?" They see that. They see, like, well, live baby, that's a good thing. Dead baby, that's a bad thing. Who broke that baby? Or what mommy didn't want to be a mommy that let that happen? Now, those are the kind of natural things that children ask. And I know it too from being out on the front lines of the pro-life movement. When parents allow their children to ask those questions, it's natural curiosity. And they always come up being 100% pro-life, the kids do, because it's human nature. Of course we don't kill babies, right? You know?
Yeah, so kids are saddened by this.
Yes, they are. They absolutely are. Now, of course, you've taken your testimony and you've developed a whole ministry, because I don't want people to think, oh, well, Melissa, she's just one story. But oh, no, because you were so brave to speak out, it's kind of like Silent No More. Abortion survivors, you're Silent No More now. Tell us a little bit about your ministry, Abortion Survivors.
Yeah, you're so right. When we get out there and we share our stories and we break through the silence and the shame that our culture and the mainstream media heaps upon any of us, you find that the stories start to come out. So the first time it happened, it was pretty, you know, quickly after I came forward with my story. And the first time I thought, oh my goodness, there's another one. But then it happens more and more and all the time. And so, you know, years ago, I would do as much as I could behind the scenes to support survivors and, you know, find opportunities to help them safely share their story. But really in 2019, when all of that aggressive legislation swept across the nation, what we saw, and I know you see it in your Silent No More population, when abortion gets out there in the culture, people are impacted by it who have otherwise stuffed it down and thought, man, I can put that in a shelf and I can go on with my life and I can be okay. And 2019 happened as we were talking about infanticide and legalizing abortion up until the point of birth. And I had a multitude of survivors overwhelmingly coming forward and saying, I'm not okay. I can't do this anymore. I can't keep it on a shelf. Can you help me? And that was my moment of saying, okay, Lord, all these years I've been finding other people to help them. Is it me? And so that led us to become a 501c3. We now have a healing program. I wrote a specific healing curriculum for survivors that people have found to be incredibly effective in transforming them. I mean, we talk about everything from rejection to living in a culture that champions the very act that was meant to end our lives. We talk about grief, how to navigate relationships with family members that is very, very complicated. I mean, that list goes on and on. So we run healing groups. We just did our first ever abortion survivor healing retreat and had 17 survivors from the United States there. We do community groups. You know, relationships are very healing and empowering to people who are impacted by abortion. And for survivors, it's kind of tenfold. We need to know that we're not alone. There's something so impactful of saying, me too, I experienced that, or I've struggled with this. I didn't know what this was. I've been told by my family, I don't talk about this. So we do community groups. We now offer educational programs. So training survivors how to speak publicly. We just had 7 survivors speak together for the first time at an Empowered by Life event. So we're training them how to speak. We have a speaking coach. We're teaching them what does it mean to advocate? What's policy? How do you get involved in all of these things? So we're just getting started. And we also do policy work on the other side of things also, because I truly believe survivors' voices are one of the powerful pieces to ending abortion.
Absolutely. And so about how many survivors do you have in your network currently? And of course, this is a call out to people. The website is what? AbortionSurvivors.org. .org. Okay, AbortionSurvivors.org. Everything Melissa's telling you about is up there. But as of this conversation, about how many survivors do you have in your network?
403 confirmed stories.
Wow.
And I'm sure
you, amazing.
Isn't that amazing? But I have a list, Janet, probably about 150 deep of people who have touched base and said, I'm a survivor too, and have not shared details. And we get that a lot. And I'm sure you do with women and men who have experienced abortion.
You know, we have on our Silent No More website, we have a thing that says, I regret my abortion, but want to be anonymous. Like just it's like a me too. Yes, they check. Mm-hmm. And for the men, I regret my lost fatherhood, but I want to be anonymous. And they check that. And we have a lot, like you're saying, people who like, well, I don't want to tell my whole story, or I don't want to be on the internet with my story. However, count me with the voices who are speaking. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think is so powerful is that it's kind of like they want to do that me too. It's me too. You're brave enough to speak. I don't want to speak, but count my voice with your voice. So I would say you probably have, if you have 400 and change, I bet you have double or triple of that out there who have survived an abortion. And I mean, I hope everyone is listening right to understand how incredible this is, because like you just said, and I know, Melissa, you've testified in Congress, haven't you?
Multiple times. Yeah, I don't keep track anymore. I just say yes.
Yeah.
The first time I thought, I don't know if I can do this. There must be somebody else that God is calling to do this. And, you know, I'll never forget stepping outside that day after an extremely long hearing. And that was about defunding Planned Parenthood. Gianna, Jessa, and I were testifying together. And I stepped out and I called my husband and I said, I'm not scared of them anymore.
Yeah, incredible, right? And when you think about the fact that we have that bill, the Born Alive Infant Protection Bill, Nancy Pelosi is keeping it locked in a closet somewhere. She won't let it even come to the House. We know it would lose because the Democrats right now outnumber the Republicans in the House. But she won't even let it come out for a floor vote, as you know, just to get the people on the record. Like, okay, you don't even want to protect a baby born alive from an abortion. You want that baby left, like you're saying, left to die. Mm-hmm. So have you ever, I know you've gone into the halls of Congress, But for that bill in particular, have you been asked to come forward to speak to that, to kind of shake them up, to say, you know, come on, this is pure and simple? I mean, you know what, Melissa, I look at it this way, and I compared this in my book, Recall Abortion. I said, you know what, if this was puppies, right, that were born and then floundering for life, right, they would be doing everything possible to save the puppies or save the kittens or save, but this is a baby. Mm-hmm. Heart beating, left gasping for air, you know, because I don't think people understand when the babies are born like this from an abortion, they're not just born like a normal cry and here we go, because they were almost killed and now they're floundering and grasping. It's like a fish pulling out of water and floundering on the deck, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, but have you, when you've walked the halls of Congress and did testify, did you look some of those pro-abortion Democrats right in the eye? Did you get a chance to do that?
That's one of my favorite things to do. you know, you sit in front of them for a few hours and, you know, I continuously essentially stare them down because I want them to see that I am looking directly at them. Good this is you. Not an ambiguous issue. This is not, you know, a choice, a right, healthcare, whatever they want to call it on that given day, a woman's right. I mean, and that's the question that I've begged so many times, Janet, is, you know, if this is a supposed right, how is that very right that I can now execute as an adult female? You know, how is that simultaneously, you know, how is that my right when it was supposed to end my life?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It's a little absurd.
Well, you know, Melissa, you're amazing. I love that, you know, we haven't connected in a long time, but I'm so glad we connected today. I just want to remind, hold up your book, okay? You Carried Me, available on Amazon. It's an amazing book. I tell you, brothers and sisters, get that book, You Carried Me, Amazon. And then, of course, go to Melissa's website, abortionsurvivors.com. And I'm sure you feel like I do, like with Silent No More. Repeat the stories to change hearts and minds. These people are sharing their testimonies because they want to change hearts and minds and wake up our culture that somehow thinks abortion's okay. So God bless you, Melissa. I'll look forward to us maybe getting together at one of these pro-life leaders meetings real soon, okay?
Thank you, Janet.
And tell your daughter, she's too old now, I won't dare want to pinch her cheeks anymore. Okay?
Will do.
Okay, God bless you. Well, brothers and sisters, I hope this inspired you too to say you have to get involved. You have to speak up. If you hear of someone who's pregnant and considering an abortion, talk about Melissa's story and really speak up and go to optionline.org, where there are pregnancy resource centers all over the country that can help and give real help. And just remember, there are some abortions only you can stop and some lives only you can save. Join me again next time on Just Ask Janet. God bless.
This has been the End Abortion Podcast. To learn more, to help end abortion, and to connect with us on social media, visit endabortion.net.